From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. Today, I'm joined by Krijn van der Raat. Krijn is an experienced CTO who has grown products, teams, and companies from startups to established tech companies and successful exits. Trust me, I was there to see all of this. In the past, he led technology at companies like GreatCall, now part of Best Buy Health, AppFolio, and MindTouch. Today, he's a fractional CTO and advisor to multiple startups. He also coaches and mentors other CTOs using his experience as a leadership coach, as well as he's been there, done that, hands-on experience to help others grow into the leaders they want to be. You can find more information at leadcto.com. Krijn, my good friend, man, we've got some years on our friendship.
Yeah.
I have a habit of attaching value and meaning to friendships based on how many years I've known people.
Yeah. But how many years do you think it is? It's like,
I'm going to say it's like 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than that. Seven. Yeah. Krijn van der Raat, or as the Americans would say, Krijn.
Krijn van der Raat.
Krijn van der Raat. We're both in San Diego. Welcome to the CTO Podcast. Super thankful to have you on the show. And thanks for putting up with all the technical difficulties. As I was telling Krijn, this is the first recording I'm doing, not only in 2024, but in 6 or 7 months. So I feel pretty rusty. So an old friend to hold my hand through this.
Well, you're welcome.
Krijn, I want to start my episodes in a new way this year, and I want to just roll straight into what it is that fascinates you. I would love to know. I know, Krijn, you're a technical leader. You've got an illustrious history as a technical leader in some pretty amazing companies. So, as a fellow CTO, I think you're out now in the fractional world, the coaching world. Is that true?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Fractional CTO and CTO coach mentor.
Great. So let's talk about that. What fascinates Krijn?
Well, in that space, what fascinates me is how my experience over the years and, you know, having been part of 7 CTOs where, for the listeners, I've spent countless days in a forum with other CTO types, helping each other, processing issues, and you learn a lot about what can happen. And it's fascinating to me how quickly somebody like me can come into a startup and see what's going well, what isn't, and what to do about it, and very quickly have a big impact. A lot of startups end up with a founding engineer who grows into the CTO and starts with that title, but the chances of actually being an effective CTO once you have more than 2 handfuls of people working for you, sometimes earlier, the chances are probably less than 50%, right? Being a great first engineer does not make you a great CTO at a rapidly growing startup. But a lot of the problems you run into are, if you look at it, they're very similar, and you can apply not the same solution, right? Every situation is different, but you can apply those fairly quickly. Secretly, I think, so hopefully none of my clients are listening, that it's really the confidence that you've been there before that makes all the difference, because we're all hypothesizing that a particular thing will work and then we go for it. And I think it's the confidence and the willingness to just do what it takes to make it work that really makes the difference. It's not some secret know-how.
So the fascination for you on the professional side, just that journey from accomplished maybe, or a super technical, amazing developer, technical person, technical mind into this role that really builds companies and creates life-giving just purpose to employees and customers, that journey?
Yeah. So I learned a lot of things the hard way. For about 10 years, I was part of Great Call, now part of Best Buy Health. And I really grew up there. I was in my late 20s. I joined as an engineer and then became director and VP and in the end, CTO. It was a great place for me to experiment with leadership styles, organizational structures. And we were growing at, I think, like the Goldilocks rate. There were a few years where we doubled our engineering org, which that's hard doing that a few years in a row. And you realize like things that work at 10 people don't work at 20, and things that worked at 20 people don't work at 40. And the same with successful companies grow, they build more products and more features. And, you know, you have to change the way you manage the work.
Talk to me about that, because the Goldilocks rate, when I see CTOs who have to work with less money, they almost seem to thrive. I mean, yes, it's not easy, but doing more with less is a, I'm going to say, a very comfortable place for a lot of technical leaders. Because A, we can build stuff ourselves. B, we've got networks that we can rely on to build stuff for us. The part that I see as more intimidating and frightening is when there's more money that needs to be spent and the cash is rolling into your coffers and the mandate is, Crane, we got to spend more money. From what I've seen, there's a rare breed of CTO that thrives in that environment.
Yeah, I've never been in that environment. Even at Great Call, it was very clear that every dollar we spent on R&D was money that we didn't spend on marketing to gain new customers, right? This was a consumer business. So it's very clear you spend money to gain subscribers. Hopefully you retain them for a very long time. And we really just optimized those two major expense categories or investment categories. So I certainly was not in the situation where there was more money that I could spend. I've been part of organizations where at some point that was the case, where there's like a fixed investment and it was just like, go build teams to build more features. And it sounds great. The thing is that I think a good engineer wants to believe that they're building something that will be useful for actual human beings, right? We can get really wrapped up into like creating really beautiful solutions. But ultimately, I think we all get to the point, we've all had the hard experience where we built something great that nobody gave a shit about. That's really hard. So you want to believe that you're building something that's useful for real human beings, that's meaningful. And if you just have crazy money to spend, you're going to build some useless stuff.
Mm.
I think it's hard in the long run to motivate teams when you're doing that. Growing in a product, of course, there's experimentation, but there's a difference between thoughtful experimentation based on customer discovery and some validated assumptions and just throwing against the wall and seeing what sticks, right?
I like that, because you're saying, I've never thought of it this way. In a way, the constrained budget or the constrained spending, and I'm not talking about fiscal responsibility, I'm just talking about there's not enough money. That actually forces us to focus on meaningful build.
I think so, yeah.
And what you're saying is that that actually contributes then to developers feeling like maybe there's more purpose. Because yes, I agree. If they're just observing all these people being hired, all these projects being built, everything is important, which means that nothing is important, then it's like, well, what am I doing here? Now, that's a great perspective.
Yeah. And I think for me personally, I've always liked the challenge of having multiple constraints and very ambitious goals and then optimizing how we can use our limited resources as best as possible to meet those goals. I find that a fascinating challenge. And I get kind of bored if I don't get to really sink my teeth into that particular problem.
That is fascinating. Fascinating. I mean, I haven't thought of scarcity being sort of an inspiration to quality work. Does this relate to your passion for prepping and maybe having duct tape and a screwdriver in a bunker and trying to sort survived.
It probably does. I think it also stems from being Dutch, and we're pretty frugal. We're socially pretty liberal and tolerant people, or at least we used to be. But fiscally, we're responsible. I learned to really be mindful of expenses and think about every euro or guilder I'd spend. So it kind of comes natural to me. I do think that it also made it easy for me to kind of fall in love with the idea of thinking things through and preparing for all possible scenarios. Because you're essentially, as you're planning a roadmap or you're planning your work, you're using some heuristics in your mind to try and figure out what is the optimal path to meeting as many of our objectives as possible, right? And there's always, as CTO types, people always want more than we can give and our teams can give. I really like that challenge because the things in your roadmap are all related to one another, right? So you really have to think through, okay, if we can accomplish this, then we can build this other thing on top of that. But if we can't, we may have to do this other thing to meet that objective. And I think that's a really interesting algorithm that our minds are hopefully well equipped to follow. And it's the same with prepping, where I got into that several years ago and people make fun of it and have these ideas of, well, you're just going to sit in a bunker with a bunch of like army rations and guns. And it's definitely not like that. That actually does not prepare you well for anything. It's just a waste of time and money.
Well, the way I see it is those people who make fun of you should just go take a careful look at how fragile our supply chain is, and then we'll talk again.
Yeah.
I think it was in 2008 when we had the massive collapse. I read something that we were 24 hours away from zero food being shipped to any grocery stores in the United States.
Yep.
I mean, talk about the reptilian brain responding to there is no food. I have to protect my family.
Yeah.
Some crazy stuff.
Yeah. And not too long later, we had about a 48-hour, more than 24-hour power outage here in San Diego.
I remember that.
And interesting things happen. Like first people go outside and like, well, let's just go for a walk and enjoy the neighborhood, right? That was really fun. And we did that. Well, a friend of mine lived in a different neighborhood. He's like, oh no. Fairly quickly, I heard gunshots and we locked all the doors and closed the curtains, right? So knowing how your neighbors respond to the thought of, well, there's not going to be law enforcement, or people are going to just do what they want because they think there won't be any consequences.
I mean, we see that all the time. Just there seems to be a human condition loop that if it's true, we just all go back crazy.
Yeah.
I want to kind of shift to maybe some books you've read. What book have you read recently that you think our people should read, or what takeaways have you had that has sort of altered your thinking?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to mention a book that is kind of related to preparing for possible futures. This book is called Imaginable. It's by Jane McGonigal. So she's a very unique person who is both a game developer and futurist. In the first few chapters, or the premise of the book, is that she runs simulations of future possible events. And in 2010, she ran a very interesting simulation where she asked tens of thousands of people to imagine a future 10 years into the future, so around 2020, where there was a pandemic of a communicable disease that required people to stay home, only go out wearing masks for protection. And there were a few other things going on. There were massive wildfires. There was an online misinformation campaign going on, which made it really hard for people to understand what was real and what wasn't. So coincidentally, she completely accurately described pretty much exactly 10 years into the future. She wrote the book not to say, I told you so, even though she did. It was to make the point that what seemed unimaginable to all of us was actually imaginable, because she did. And tens of thousands of people were part of this social experiment where for 6 weeks, she asked them to essentially live in this future world with a whole bunch of these constraints. So there were 10,000 people across the world who would go out wearing a mask. They would go out to the grocery store and they'd get weird looks from people, and they would record their experience. And that was all part of this experiment. And a few interesting things happened, right? Besides, you know, aside from her completely accurate prediction, she would start getting letters from people who were part of that experiment in 2020, thanking her for allowing them to experience this 10 years ago, because I remember it was really hard to get the kids to wear a mask. You would get weird looks depending on which part of the country you were in, whether people wanted to wear masks or not. And it was all kind of a pain in the ass to deal with it. But the people who had imagined this before 10 years ago, they did not experience as much stress, anxiety. They were actually prepared for it. And this fascinated me. And in this book, she spends a little bit of time saying, you can actually imagine this stuff and predict it. But then she describes, okay, what do you do with that? And she runs these simulations for big global organizations, for governments, to help them really prepare for what might happen. And the techniques that she describes for how to get there, those have really changed the way I lead. I'll give you an example of where I use that. A company I left about a half year ago, we were trying to take a really big code base and product and try to get it from daily deployments. And this is a product that had hundreds of engineers working on a single code base. We deploy it every day. We wanted to go to continuous deployment. And it was really hard. Just imagine that many pull requests a day and doing that safely. So we couldn't really imagine that. And so the techniques that she described on how to get people to believe that something is possible, we use that in some workshops, because the thing is, our brains are really amazing simulation machines, right? We're constantly simulating what we think is reality, the world around us and inside us, based on the input that we get. And we can simulate that. We do that as we sleep and dream, right? It feels real. Well, you can put yourself kind of in that state consciously and then imagine what a particular future would be like. And we apply that, and it's really amazing, because doing hard things is really hard, and it's impossible if people don't believe the vision, the end goal.
Yeah. I think the ability for us, even in our CTO roles or technical leadership, to bring the stakeholders or the C-suite with us. And as you said earlier in the chat, the ability to paint various scenarios, give people options so that they can make decisions. I think this is a really fascinating approach to help people imagine the things that they talk about or the things that they don't think is possible. She actually wrote another book, Reality is Broken.
Oh, that's on my list.
That is a brilliant book, because it overnight changed my view on kids playing games. I think she was on the World of Warcraft team or something. But I saw a TED talk that she gave one day, and she talked about the fact that our kids are solving millions of problems. I think she said by the time a kid gets to elementary school, they would have solved more puzzles than our generation by the time we go to high school. So something like that. It's not great to be on a podcast and quote a story that's inaccurate, but something to the effect of the order of magnitude of problems that are being solved through puzzles in games. And she was just basically saying the reality is actually broken, and the simulated environment of problem solving is actually what is training our brains. So she's awesome.
Yeah.
It's called Imaginable.
Yep.
I love that. Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7 CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7CTOs.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. So let's come down to some tooling. You playing around with any tools lately? Tools that you love? Tools that you find indispensable?
Yeah. I mean, like most of us, I've been playing around a lot with ChatGPT and just Gen AI tools to see how it can make myself more effective. And boy, is it a treasure trove. I don't really start anything without just telling ChatGPT, you're my ... assistant. You're knowledgeable, confident. Don't give me the disclaimers. Just pretend like you know it. Start with this. And I do it when I'm trying to prototype something in, you know, a language or framework I'm not familiar with. I use it in everything I do, essentially. It just helps me get started. It's like having, I really like the Copilot branding because that's what it feels like. It's, you know, I have like a mid-level software engineer to bounce ideas off of. And it's just like asking a normal mid-level software engineer. It's not always completely correct, but that doesn't really matter, right? Like people aren't perfect. Our AIs are also not perfect, but it just keeps me from being unstuck. And it makes programming so much more fun because I am not spending, you know, 4 hours reading different articles to try and figure out how do I accomplish this. I just ask it and usually the answer is right.
What I find extremely helpful is when I can just copy the error message and just say, but I got this error when I tried to do what you said I should do. And ChatGPT is like, oh, yes, that's yes. I was thinking that might happen. I agree with you. The ability, not only in sort of the generative aspect of the text that's being thrown at us, but I think our brains are being trained to have a conversation. It's the rubber duck thing. You're actually conversing with the search engine.
Yeah. It just feels very natural to me.
Yeah.
It's really great. It's what I've always hoped Alexa and Siri would become, and they never really quite got there.
Do you think that as technical teams, CTOs, whatever, that we should insist on our developers using Copilot? Or ChatGPT.
Totally. We ran an experiment at AppFolio where we adopted Copilot. It was a large team and you can't stop engineers from trying to improve their own developer experience, right? So some were using it and we said, okay, well, let's set it up through our corporate GitHub account so we can ensure that that very important little checkbox that says, don't use my data to train the model is checked. And then we said, okay, now please go use it. And we ran it, like everything we did there, we ran an experiment with a small group of people, measured the impact, and it was about a 20% productivity gain instantly. So yes, then we said, okay, everybody, you have access now. Please use it. It's going to make you faster, better. So I think it's insane if you're not using it.
That's very interesting. And then talk to me about Jupyter Notebooks. I've never used it. I don't actually know what it is. So talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old.
Yeah. So if you're a data scientist, I'm making air quotes here. Listeners can see that. But if you do stuff with data, if you're a data engineer, you probably use Python. You probably use Pandas. And that's a really fun stack because most of your data operations are like a single line of code on a data frame when you're using Pandas. And most people who do that kind of work, I hope they're using Jupyter Notebooks, which is to me, it's such a great developer experience because it's a notebook. It looks like a document, essentially, and you're writing text. And then you have these code blocks and there's a little play button and you can just hit play and then it runs the code and it shows you the results, right? If you do print screen, you'll see some output, but better yet, you include some graph when you're using them data. Usually you get the best insights by looking at charts and graphs that represent the data and those just show up in there as well. So when you're coding in an IDE, you have your code probably separate from your documentation and your comments. Maybe you have some good comments in there, but the output shows up, I don't know, somewhere else, wherever you run it. Well, this has all those things together. So your code, your comments, the stuff around the code to help people understand it, and your outputs are nicely in line. And so you can just go hit play on your code, hit play on your whatever line of code that generates a chart. If it's not right, you just go back and replay it. It's such a great iterative kind of developer experience that I really hope to just get that for every stack.
It's so funny. When I heard people talk about Jupyter Notebooks years ago, I thought it was an actual laptop, like a notebook laptop. I was like, is this a new brand of laptop? I'm really sorry, people. This is a CTO podcast, but I also don't know what I read about pandas the other day. What is that?
It's a Python library that has a lot of data manipulation functions built into it. If you're massaging data, right? So let's say you're the person who does 80% of the work for any machine learning project, which is getting the data, cleaning the data, modeling the data so that somebody can run a model. And then, you know, tell you to go back and do it all over again, right? Like 80% of the work of machine learning is really data engineering up front. So all of the things that you need to do to read a CSV file, validate it, correct all the crappy data that's in there, filter it out, select your features, model that and output a data set that's clean and ready to use for an analytics project or data or machine learning project, whatever. So pandas it's like a power tool for all of those steps. That's how I use it. I mean, I'm sure people use it for other things as well, but yeah.
How would you recommend people listening to this get their hands dirty with Jupyter Notebooks?
I would recommend just going to Google Colab, which is basically free Google branded version of Jupyter Notebooks. It looks a little slicker, but it's the same general experience. You can very easily have it connect to a CSV file that's in your Google Drive or whatever, or a database that's in your Google Cloud. It's pretty trivial. It's like, you know, two lines of code or something. So I would start there. Everybody has some Google account somewhere. It's inevitable. So it's the easiest way to get started. And if you want to learn more about how to do data science-y stuff with pandas, I took a Coursera course from, I think it was University of Michigan, and they just put their data science specialization on Coursera. It's the same course, I think, same professor, great lab assignments. You can audit it for free. Coursera does a really good job of trying to convince you that you have to pay, but you don't. You can do all this stuff for free. And I thought it was a great course. It was well-structured. If you like playing with data, I think that's a great tool set, and I really enjoyed it.
Great, great. Well, let's end off our chat with getting into the stratosphere. I'm always curious when I talk to people like you, how you view the world. What is a problem that exists in the world today that you feel most passionate about solving or about thinking about? Or just share some thoughts for me on that.
Yeah, we're really ending on a on a high note here. I'm just amazed at, on average, how poor leadership is across the board. One of the reasons I gravitate towards startups is because you see a lot less of it there. Leadership is really, to me, is about getting a group of people to believe and feel and experience that you're all in it together, that you have a mission and that you're doing what it takes to accomplish it together. That feels great. If you've been in that, it's being on a winning team where you feel like you belong is freaking awesome. most organizations don't hold on to that for very long. I think maybe there's a maximum size, maximum number of people that can sustain that, because as companies grow, and I've been at companies that have been much larger than that, who've tried to hold on to that, it's hard. It takes a lot of hard work. I think we end up reverting to something that matches like a hierarchy, a pyramid, right? Where there's somebody usually with money on top who dictates everything and everybody just does things to benefit the top. Even our experiments in democracy, it's messy, but the threat of ending up with a dictatorship are always there. I mean, it feels kind of current, right? I just wonder, what is it about humanity, about human disposition that we gravitate towards that, right? Whenever we're in fear or we doubt things, we cling on to whoever can authoritatively tell us what to do, and then we'll just do it for safety or protection or I don't know what. It's just a bummer that it always seems to go to that.
I like how you start sort of in this startup world where you have to inspire people, you have to bring them along with you. And so the failed leadership is very evident very quickly, because the two devs that you psyched up to come and code and work with you to build the startup left. And it's like, okay, well, clearly your leadership didn't produce any inspired retention there.
Yeah.
I came into this year thinking about this a little bit as well, in the sense that I think that there's a doing aspect that gets lost a little bit. Leaders, I think, can get lost in being in the leadership system and actually forget that there's a level of doing that they are responsible for. There's an interesting story in South Africa. We have this deterioration of our roads happening. Like, basically, our roads are becoming undrivable, except for the national roads. All the small surface roads, especially in one of our provinces, is basically potholes. I'm talking about undrivable. It's so bad that you have to drive on the side of the road. Driving on the side of the road is better than driving on the road. But the thing that happened there was, now, I don't want to talk about political corruption, because that's not what I'm actually talking about. I'm talking about this system of leadership that exists where becoming the Minister of Transport holds with it a level of prestige, because you are now part of a leadership system. And that leadership system requires maintenance, placation, donation, promises, kickbacks. And I'm not talking about political corruption. I'm talking even about mid-level startups. And then you forget, you spend so much time nurturing that leadership that you forget that there's actually a $10 billion budget that's waiting for you to act on it.
Yep.
I'm oversimplifying, but I often think that even at a micro level, the being a leader, sometimes you forget that it still requires a level of tactical understanding. It still requires doing your homework and understanding the intricacies and the complexities of things that might feel way beneath you.
Yeah.
And I then think you get so caught up in the maintenance mode of meetings and saving your face, pleasing, explaining, that I just think that there becomes a decoupling between the position of leadership and the reason that you are in that position.
Yeah. I think you make a really, really good point there. It is very important, especially for leaders, to remember and probably need constant reminder who you're working for. If you're a company with customers, that's who you're working for. And your team is everybody in the company. And those are your key stakeholders, right? It's easy to go, well, what's in it for me? Because that's where you want to impress your boss or the shareholders or whatever, so that you get something. I think that's where that starts going wrong. I think that's the point you're making here.
I wonder if one can change one's view of who you're working for from I am working for my customer to I am working for my team.
Mm-hmm. You can. The problem is if you focus on your team first, I agree they're really important. And I've done this where I've focused more on my team than on the customer or the company as a whole, is you get different camps, right? Because there's always more than one team within an organization. Unless you're a tiny startup, if you're a handful of people, then that's the team. The team is the company and it's one. But as you grow, you'll start getting groups and departments, and they're not always going to agree on things. So you need to be able to work through disagreement to come to solutions. And if you care more about your team than your customers, then you're likely going to push for things that benefit your team or your team wants, right? Maybe everybody is focused on the customer, but they believe they can serve them better in a different way. I think in that case, you can work through it. That's sort of, you know, you just need to reconcile those different perspectives. And you can, if you have a good facilitator, you can do that somewhat objectively. But if you're focusing on what's best for your team, then you're creating camps within the company.
Yeah, I can see that.
Focusing on your team is better than focusing on yourself. It's like somewhere in the middle, right? Yourself should, as a leader, you should come last. Let's just put it that way.
I think that there's this fallacy, which is hire good people and get out of their way. I really think that's a fallacy. I think that good leadership is hire good people and be right there with them, present.
Yeah.
Challenging them, questioning. But I think a lot of times we think, well, I have a great VP of engineering, or I have six great engineering managers, so I'm going to go off and do other things. And I understand that there is a context in which you operate, which is the system of leadership that you have to be an active participant in. But I think it's really hard for people to do both. It's hard for me to do both. And it's really a decision that when I'm considering myself right now, there's really a decision point that I have to make, which is, am I going to take the next 25 minutes to think about what the developers are talking about or what my management team is talking about? And I think a lot of times I see things without actually making the effort to dig into it. You know, sometimes I see a to-do assigned to me and I don't actually read the to-do. I just see that there's a to-do assigned to me. maybe it's a me problem.
No. I know what you mean. In a role of CTO, you really need to know a lot about a lot of things and be part of a lot of different groups or spheres within a company. That's hard. It's hard to do that to the level of thoroughness that we want out of ourselves, right? We're engineers. We'd like to turn black boxes into white boxes. We like to know how things work to the intricate detail. That takes time. You know, you get better at it over time and you start to recognize patterns, but those patterns can send you in the wrong direction, right? You need to validate your assumptions, and that always takes time. So yeah, we drop balls all over the place, right? It's just about dropping as few important balls as possible, I guess, and making sure that you maintain trust.
So ending on a high note, what do you love to see in leadership? What do the leaders that you really look up to carry that it really makes you think, wow, this is the pinnacle of our species?
I think people who naturally inspire trust through sincerity and just a complete lack of ego and willingness to do what it takes to help their team and to help whoever they're working for, whoever their work should benefit. My first real mentor, he was a COO, and he was a very modest person in his demeanor, and he would introduce himself as the janitor or something like that. I asked him, like, why? And he's like, well, look, if they need me to clean the toilet, I'll clean the toilet. And that's pretty much how I've joined teams as leader several times now, and that's always hard to do. But the first thing I do is, okay, which toilets need to be cleaned? Not actual toilets, but metaphorical toilets. Like, what's the stuff that gets in your way that nobody wants to do? And then I just do it. And that just instantly breeds trust.
I love it. I love it. I call it the, are you willing to fix the printer?
Yeah. Fancy load letter? What does that mean?
If... if the printer's broken, man, I'll walk out and I'll go fix that thing because I know literally no. And then the second one that's close to that is the Wi-Fi access point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that summarizes it beautifully. As the leaders to whom no task that any of their people needs to do is beneath them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. Good. Krein, so tell me, as we say goodbye, your coaching services, your fractional services, is it at KreinRocks.com?
Well, right now it's at KreinVanderot.com, which
come
is...
Come on, man, dude.
No. It is the worst... I have the worst name to do that to, but I had to pick something. I'm going to come up with a better name, but I'm pretty sure my name will be somewhere written down where you listen to this. If you Google me, you will definitely find me, and you can misspell my name several times. It'll still lead to the right place because there's never, ever been anyone with that name.
The model has been trained.
Yes.
K-R-I-J-N.
Yep.
V-A-N-D-E-R. R-A-A-D-T.
Yep.
Nailed it. Thank you, Krein. Very, very good to see you. Thanks for being with me, and I'll see you around.
Yeah, well, thank you. This was a blast.
Awesome. Cheers. That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.